When we look out at the universe beyond our own Milky Way, we were surprised and delighted to find that there are galaxies practically everywhere. Galaxies come in a variety of sizes, shapes, and with varying amounts of dust, gas, and star formation in them. But galaxies also come clumped and clustered together. Most of them contain supermassive black holes at their centers. Some of them are relatively isolated, while others exist in groups, clusters, or even superclusters and larger structures where they all seem to be brought together under the force of gravity. But this is not due exclusively to the effect of normal matter, but also due to an unseen form of invisible matter known as dark matter. What's the connection between galaxies and how they're clustered and distributed and dark matter? Find out on this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. There are many different aspects of galaxies and how they move, both internally and relative to one another, that allows us to draw the conclusion that the normal matter we know of, things made of protons, neutrons, and electrons, can't be all there is to the universe. We need some extra ingredient, some form of mass that doesn't absorb or emit light to help us make sense of this. That idea is known as dark matter. And here to help us explore it and its role in astrophysical environments, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Keyshawn Ivory. Keyshawn is a PhD candidate at the University of Vanderbilt and one of the most fun conversations I've ever gotten to have with an astronomer. Keyshawn, I'm so pleased to have you here and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So can I ask you, dark matter is one of those things that when almost everyone hears about it for the first time, they are super skeptical about it. They were like, wow, something must be really messed up if we had to resort to hypothesizing something that we can't see and we can't detect directly and we can't make our normal matter or light interact with, but yet we know it must be there. Can I ask you, what was the piece of evidence that you had presented to you about dark matter that convinced you, okay, we're not just making up some fudge factor here. This is a real physical thing that people should know. We have really good reasons to believe it's real.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say, all right, so I guess maybe the piece of evidence that was presented to me where I first came to know why we even theorized that dark matter was a thing was, of course, Vera Rubin's rotation curves, you know, that whole, as you go out further from the center of a galaxy, you would expect rotation rates to fall off in this very Keplerian sort of way if there were not more extra mass that we couldn't see. And that's where we got this idea from. And I thought, okay, that makes a lot of sense, but I don't know that I, even at that time, had this inherent sort of skepticism of, oh, it just sounds like fudge. However, when I got to the bullet cluster. So basically, essentially, the bullet cluster is this really gorgeous image that we use to teach about dark matter. Where, you know, before the bullet cluster image, you could ask this question of, how do we know this isn't just a fudge factor? How do we know that we just didn't get gravity wrong? Because there's the whole like modified Newtonian dynamics idea. But the beauty of the bullet cluster image is that we can literally see where we get the majority of the gravitational like lensing that happens. We can see the mass that's responsible for that. And then we can see where the majority of the light is coming from. And we can literally see that those are two different places. So essentially you see like a bunch of gas from this collision that's sort of caught in the middle of this big like cluster collision that's going on. And you see that's where a bunch of visible light will be coming from. And then you see on either side of that gas, you see the mass is actually responsible for the lensing, the actual bending, the warping of space-time. And so if dark matter isn't a thing, then you have to ask yourself, why is it that the mass responsible for the majority of the bending of space-time and the mass that's responsible for the visible light are in two different places? So that was kind of, it was presented to me as sort of like the smoking gun for why we invest so much time and energy and belief in dark matter and not something like, you know, modified Newtonian dynamics. And so when it was pitched to me that way, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, this sounds like a pretty solid basis for why we incorporate this into all of our simulations, like why we spend so much time building detectors to look for it. Like, if you're going to sink all this energy into something, all this time into something, yeah, okay, I buy it. Yeah, so I'd say that was kind of my tipping point.
You know, I think that's a really solid one to go with. You know, the bullet cluster is, imagine you have two galaxy clusters, cluster A and cluster B, and they're located near each other in space initially, so they're going to gravitationally tug on each other. And inside each of these galaxy clusters, you have a bunch of small things. You have a bunch of galaxies that are very small compared to the size and scale of the overall cluster. So when you have these two galaxy clusters, cluster A and cluster B, gravitationally interact, they're going to speed towards each other, and they're going to, you would think, collide with each other. Well, the individual galaxies inside are small compared to the size of the cluster. So when you get a cluster-cluster collision, it turns out galaxy collisions are rare. Most of these galaxies are going to pass right through each other, the same way if you took two rifles loaded with birdshot, you know, 100 yards apart from each other, and you fired the rifles at each other, those little tiny pellets of birdshot, they're not going to hit each other. They're going to pass right through each other. And that's kind of what the individual galaxies do. But inside these clusters, you also have a tremendous amount of gas. And in fact, from previous X-ray studies, we've been able to determine that somewhere around 80% or more of the mass associated with a cluster in the form of normal matter has to be in this form of gas. So when the clusters collide, the individual galaxies pass through each other, but the gas collides and slows down and heats up and emits X-rays. And you would think, well, if most of the normal matter in there is in the form of gas, then when you make your gravitational lensing maps, you're going to see that mass located in the same spot where the X-rays are coming from. But like you said, they're not. It's as though there was this additional form of mass, like five times as much as was present in that X-ray emitting gas, that simply passed right through one another, that stayed attached to cluster A and cluster B. And if you don't have some new form of matter, something that only interacts gravitationally, that isn't made of protons, neutrons, and electrons, you wouldn't be able to see that. So I think if you're looking for a smoking gun, that's a pretty good one. If then you go and accept, okay, dark matter exists, what does that tell us for, say, each individual galaxy that we see out there in the universe? What would be the implications of, okay, if dark matter exists, how would it be related to the galaxies that we see?
Mm-hmm. Great question also. So I guess I could come at this from maybe circling back to the Vera Rubin's rotation curve. So that's one way that dark matter would be related to the galaxies themselves, is thinking about the distribution of dark matter that must be within the galaxies. And as you go out to the sort of outer reaches away from where the bulk of the stars and planets and things are, you get into what, from a visible light point of view, looks maybe sort of empty, but from a dark matter point of view, is full of the stuff, which is fascinating to me. But then also thinking about the relation between dark matter and galaxies, you kind of have to talk about large scale structure as well. So the way that individual galaxies are composed, like in relation to each other, where they are in relation to each other, and the sort of large scale, we call it like cosmic web, dark matter is very kind of at the center of seeding that larger structure, and we can, of course, get into that. But yes, in terms of how dark matter relates to individual galaxies, I think about the composition of those galaxies and the position of those galaxies in relation to one another.
All right, so let's think about this then. We've got a universe with galaxies within it, right? And if I watch one of these galaxies evolve and grow up over cosmic time, I start to wonder about things, and maybe some ways I start to worry about things, right? I watch this galaxy rotate, and even though I'm, you know, maybe long lived for a human and I'll wind up being 100 years old, in the span of 100 years, I don't really get to see many changes to a galaxy. But if I have a galaxy that I'm seeing edge on, right, rather than face on, where I can't see the spirals, but I see a disk galaxy edge on, I can look near the center of that galaxy and see, okay, I see that things aren't really moving very fast towards me or away from me. But as I move out farther and farther away from the center, I see, oh, now I see these rapid motions. But as I continue to go farther out, I see, like you were saying earlier, oh, I'm not seeing something like the solar system where Mercury orbits the sun the fastest, and then as we go out, Venus, Earth, Mars, all the way out to Neptune, I see the farther away a planet is from the sun, the slower it revolves around the sun, the slower it's moving. When I look at galaxies, I don't see that happening at all. When I look at galaxies, the farther and farther out I go, I see that rotation curve remains roughly flat. I see that things on the outskirts appear to be moving just as quickly around the center as things in the intermediate or middle section of the galaxy. And it's really hard to explain that without adding some new form of mass, because we know how gas works, and we know how plasma works, and we know how dust works, and we know how stars work, and we know how black holes work. And even if you add them all together, it's not close to enough mass to explain how these galaxies are rotating. So if I look at an individual galaxy and I can see it roughly edge on, I can know that it's rotating and that the objects, stars and gas, moving within it are moving as though there's some form of extra mass out there. Now, you mentioned something about not just looking at single galaxies, but for looking at galaxies, I would say, that are in close proximity to one another. Why would we want to do that? And how is that going to help us learn something about dark matter?
Yeah, so this is really getting into what was the content of my master's thesis. So I did a master's degree from 2019 to 2021 at Fisk University, also here in Nashville. And during that time, I worked a lot on this large-scale structure, dark matter, halos. Halo is just a word that we use to describe a clump of dark matter, essentially. I worked a lot with this idea of the structure of the universe at large. And it turns out that dark matter really is super duper implicated in all of this. And so with regard to the first question of why we would be even interested in looking at the positioning of galaxies in relation to each other, we occupy the space that we do in the Milky Way. We zoom out. The Milky Way is itself in a group of galaxies. We zoom out that group of galaxies in a larger group of galaxies. We could ask the question of, is everything in the universe kind of like evenly spaced out? Do galaxies preferentially group up together? Does that happen on a particular spatial scale? Like, these are just questions about the universe that we live in that one would actually wonder about. And so we did wonder about these things, and it turns out that dark matter can help us address these questions. So to get at the core of why that is, we kind of have to go all the way back, like all the way back to like the beginning. So we're going from like Big Bang times. So at this time of the Big Bang, basically you just have this sort of plasma, and then about like a second after that or something, you have baryons, so like particles starting to form. This is when a few like important things happen. So someone asked one time in a talk that I was watching, one of the comments that they, the question that they had was, what is dark matter doing in all of this? Like, is it there? And the speaker answered like, well, yes, it was always there. And that's important to remember, I think, for this discussion. So even at this point where the baryons are just forming, these particles are just forming, like dark matter is there, but what do we think we know about it? We think we know that it doesn't interact with light in the ways that we know normal matter does. So it's not subjected to the same like thermal processes and radiative processes that normal matter is. So dark matter is there, but it is able to, being subjected essentially only to gravity, it's able to clump up effectively, because what does gravity say? Gravity says that mass goes where other mass is, right? So if there is even a tiny little overdensity, a tiny little fluctuation in mass, that little overdensity is going to attract more mass. So dark matter is able to effectively kind of clump, not under the influence of these radiative forces or thermal forces. Normal baryonic matter cannot do that. So it is subjected to gravity. It's still trying to sort of clump and collapse to match the little fluctuations and overdensities. However, it's hot. It's really, really hot. And so you have the situation where it starts to want to clump and collapse, but that really hot matter starts to repel and kind of bounce off of each other. And that creates pressure. And that pressure makes waves, you know, sound waves that reverberate. So if you ever hear baryon acoustic oscillations, that's what this is. So while baryons are doing this, dark matter is just coalescing and actually seeding out this structure that normal matter is going to follow. And it turns out once you have the expansion of the universe happen, those small little fluctuations and overdensities become really huge ones. And that actually becomes the cosmic web as we know it. So dark matter actually seeds the structure that normal matter kind of follows. And then once expansion happens, boom, you get the cosmic web that we recognize. So it turns out that yes, where galaxies are in relation to each other is actually related to the way that dark matter was able to coalesce at the beginning of the universe, which is absolutely, like when I learned that, it was bonkers to me. Like I couldn't believe the way in which everything was related and the way that we as astronomers are able to analyze both these baryon acoustic oscillations and also the cosmic microwave background. So the radiation that was released when the universe cooled off enough for these oscillations to stop, right? That is just wild to me that we're able to actually look at that and ascertain a real explanation for the structure of the visible universe and then make conclusions about what that must mean for dark matter. I can't believe that we can do all of that. But yes, that's,
you know, that's a remarkable story and a remarkable answer, because I think a lot of people, when they hear something like dark matter, their instinct is to say like, oh, well, this does sound like a fudge factor, and how could we get rid of it? And I think it's extremely it's an extremely powerful exercise to say, okay, let's imagine the very early universe with and without dark matter, right? Either way, you have the hot Big Bang, you've got this bath of thermal radiation, and you've got early on, before you form neutral atoms, you've got ions, right? Protons, maybe some neutrons, maybe some heavier bound states of atomic nuclei, and electrons. And what's going to happen? You had these initial density imperfections in the universe, and where you have a overdensity, like you said, that's going to preferentially say, oh, well, I'm denser than average, so all the matter in the surrounding regions, I'm going to attract it to me more than those other less dense regions around are going to attract it to them. So I start to win. I start to gather more and more matter. If you have dark matter there, that dark matter isn't going to interact with the protons, neutrons, and electrons. It's not going to interact with the photons. It's just going to start to gravitationally grow. But the normal matter, well, normal matter has, like you said, heat to it. It has thermal energy to it. Normal matter also collides with other normal matter. Normal matter, especially if it's charged, like ions or electrons, is going to have a cross-section with photons, with light. So this radiation pressure is going to push back on any clumps of normal matter that try to go and bounce them out of it. And that's what makes these baryon acoustic oscillation features. So you have these bouncing effects of normal matter a lot less with dark matter. Dark matter just kind of gradually grows and accumulates matter more and more. So by the time the universe is 380,000 years old, you make neutral atoms for the first time, and snapshot. We get a snapshot of the universe that's left over from that time, what we say this cosmic microwave background is. And in that, we see there are fluctuations on various temperature scales and various distance scales. And we can see, oh, well, it looks like at this specific scale, what's about an angular scale of about 1 degree, you get a peak in these fluctuations. And they're still small. You're still talking only maybe one part in 10,000 or a few 10,000s that this is like, oh, the temperature fluctuations are a little bit greater and a little bit smaller than normal. And as you look at these different angular scales, you see these bouncing effects where, you know, you get some peaks and some valleys, and this corresponds to where you're more and less likely to have galaxies appear relative to each other. What amazes me is then you can say, well, that was a long time ago. That was back when the universe was only 380,000 years old. So what we can do is we can take those features that were imprinted in the cosmic microwave background and say, well, what were they like when the universe was hundreds of millions of years old, or when the universe was billions of years old, or when the universe is 13.8 billion years old like it is today. And you can evolve that structure forward in time theoretically and say, oh, well, what this means is if I put my finger down on a galaxy and say a galaxy is here, then I'm going to have galaxies at all these other distances from it. But somehow I'm going to be more likely to have a galaxy that's 500 million light years away from me than I am to have a galaxy that's either 400 million or 600 million light years away from me. And when we do this large-scale structure survey, we see this feature appear. We see, oh, there is this evidence that you have the baryons oscillating, but the dark matter doesn't do it. And so you can measure the magnitude of the baryon acoustic oscillations. You can see the impact on clustering. And this also gives us a window into the universe of, well, how much normal matter versus how much dark matter does it have? And again, remarkably, from the cosmic microwave background, from large-scale structure, and from looking at individual galaxies or clusters of galaxies in collision, you get that same ratio, that there's about 5 times as much dark matter as there is normal matter in all of its forms combined. And to me, that's such strong evidence that we have all of these independent lines of observational evidence to look at, and they all point towards the exact same conclusion, that there is this population of collisionless dark matter that gravitates and has mass, but that doesn't interact with normal matter or with light.
Exactly. I love telling that story.
It's a great story, but the important thing is that it's not just a story that we tell each other. It's a story that we can take it to the universe and say, hey, is this what you're like? And we can look at it and it answers and says, yes, this is what I'm like. You can't explain these things about me without dark matter. You certainly can't explain all of these disparate observations with one other observation that isn't dark matter. Like, oh, okay, maybe I could explain the rotation curve of galaxies by modifying Newton's laws. Sure, but can I get baryon acoustic oscillations by modifying Newton's laws? No. Can I get the clustering of galaxies on large scales? No. Can I get the features in the cosmic microwave background? No. So, you know, you have to say, wow, if I just have one new ingredient, dark matter, then it solves all of these cosmic problems and makes a consistent picture. Because that's what we need in physics. If we want to make sense of the universe, we need one picture to describe everything. We don't want separate pictures and separate laws of physics for each separate class of systems that we look at.
Exactly. And I always like to, like when I would, when I was a TA, for example, and I would, I taught non-majors, non-astronomy majors in lab and sometimes in lecture. And this was always a big question of how, you know, how am I meant to think about dark matter and about our models of the universe? And I think my answer to that was always kind of, well, I live in the universe just like you do. So I can't tell you what is and what isn't, but I can tell you what our best picture is. And I can tell you why it's our best picture. I can tell you why it's the best that we've got. And that's kind of all we seek to do, I feel, as astrophysicists, is come up with the best picture and know why it is the best. And for right now, dark matter, that's the best that we got. And I'm enthralled by it. I'm thrilled by it. And I like learning more about it every day.
You know, I think what you've brought up is a real important example of being humble about what we know today. You know, it would have been very easy for someone like Newton to look at the universe and say, okay, I've given you the laws of gravity, right? I've got my law of universal gravitation, and I've written out how you find equations of motion, and I have written out how optics works, and this is it. We understand everything now. Like, I've told you, this is what reality is. And I think what we've learned over time is that, all right, what Newton gave us was a picture of reality, and it was an outstanding approximation for how reality works. But we've learned that there are better approximations for how reality works in the hundreds of years since Newton, that we say, okay, well, Newton thought that space and time were absolute, and it turns out that they're actually relative to every observer within them, that each unique observer observes their own definitions for space and time. And that's why me over here in Washington State and you over there in Tennessee, we don't agree on what simultaneous means. We can agree to it within some certain threshold, but because we're at different places at different points in space and time, we're not going to agree on when something occurs, because our definitions of space and time are relative to each other. Newton didn't know that. We say that the law of universal gravitation is really great, but it doesn't explain why the position of stars appears to deflect during a total solar eclipse the closer you look towards where the sun is, right? That's something that you need a superior theory of gravity to Newton's for. You need Einstein's general relativity to get that right. And I think today, to look at our current cosmic picture and say, well, we know these things about the universe, and we see that it's consistent with our universe being made of a mix of radiation and neutrinos and normal matter and dark matter and something else called dark energy, I think it's really important to say this is the best picture of reality that we have today, and it's consistent with the observations that we make across a wide variety of lines of evidence. But I also think it's very important to not confuse that with being actual reality, because if we've learned anything, I think the answer is, well, not necessarily. And also, if we look back 100, 500, 1,000, 10,000 years from now, we're probably going to look at 21st century conception of the universe as being a little naive, the same way we look at Newton or Galileo or even Aristotle's conception of the universe as being pretty naive.
Absolutely. And I think also people, when you say that you work on dark matter related things, I think for some people, a question that naturally pops up is, okay, well, how would you feel if it turned out that, you know, dark matter wasn't the answer? And I think they would expect me to maybe be upset or disappointed because I spent all this time writing this nice master's thesis and all this. In reality, I mean, if it turns out that a better picture of the universe is out there, that's fine. Like, I'm not doing this on the assumption that it's the absolute truth. Like, I'm not doing any of this on the assumption that it's the truth. I'm doing it because it's interesting, and I'm curious what the truth is. So if it turns out that what I'm doing right now isn't it, that's cool. I had some fun, and in the future, they've got a better picture, and that's a win for humanity.
I think that's really wise, again, because this is something we've seen over the history of science, over the relatively recent history of science, right? If you went to a cosmologist in the 1960s and you told them about dark matter, they would have, like, dismissed you, and they would have been like, oh yeah, that's just Fritz Zwicky's thing. He's looking at the galaxies in this galaxy cluster and saying they move around too fast, but we don't understand how the dark baryons work, and we don't understand gas and dust and this sort of distribution, and so it's really unfair to draw a conclusion that there has to be some sort of invisible mass out there. And even though Zwicky was ultimately vindicated by the subsequent observations, I think it's a testament to how open-minded scientists are to changing their minds when new data indicates something else, that today almost everyone is like, no, dark matter is the best explanation, because we got new observations that showed us this information that we didn't have before. And now, based on this information, this is what we think the universe is made of. The same thing happened in the 90s when the supernova data started to indicate that maybe there's some form of dark energy in the universe. For a long time, people didn't think that was a possibility worth considering. And then when the data started to indicate it, we started looking at all these disparate lines of evidence and synthesizing them together. And by the mid-2000s, people were almost entirely convinced that there were very few holdouts who were like, no, I think there's still a problem with the data. And today it's even more so. We didn't come about upon our consensus picture of the universe where we have dark matter and dark energy within it lightly. This was something that it took the evidence coming in order to convince us. And I really like to think that if there is some better evidence that comes in the future that upends our picture of how the universe works and what it's made of, that we'll be just as open to changing our minds in that instance as we were in all the previous ones.
Exactly. Exactly.
So let me ask you now, now that we've got this picture in our heads of the universe, that it's made, yes, there's normal matter in it for sure, and that normal matter makes light and most of the things we can observe. It absorbs light, it emits light, it clumps together, it gravitates, it forms stars, it makes light-blocking dust, it exists in the gaseous and plasma phase in many instances. But it's not the dominant factor in forming structure in the universe. That's dark matter. Dark matter is dominant at forming structure in the universe. What are some of the ways that we can use our knowledge of dark matter and our knowledge of astrophysics to sort of make predictions about what types of objects and structures we're going to have in this universe relative to each other?
That's a really good question. So maybe one thing that kind of comes to mind in terms of using what we know about dark matter to make predictions about maybe structures and objects that we can see or observe or make other observations about. I've been reading So my current research group, we do more, it's more of a black holes sort of gravitational waves group. And of course, we'll also get into that. But as such, in our group meeting, we've been reading a lot of literature about black holes, black hole mergers, and that kind of thing. And I have been reading really interesting literature about modeling the sinking of black holes toward the center of merged galaxies, which, you know, is the first step to facilitating a black hole merger. And something I'd never, ever, ever just in my life considered before, was the impact of the presence of dark matter in a galaxy on how efficient that sinking process is, how efficient it is for that secondary black hole to sink to the center and merge with the primary. But it makes so much sense that if there is dark matter in the galaxy and it's got some mass to it and it is affected by gravity, then of course there'd be some impact on the sinking of a black hole. I literally never imagined it. And so in their model, they talked about what the impact of dark matter in their galaxy model had on the sinking and to what extent it affected the timescale of the sinking. And so that's an example maybe of the kind of, at least model-wise, a kind of thing that we can generate predictions for using what we know about dark matter and its distribution and where it is in galaxies and how much of it there is. And it's something that I thought when I was leaving that master's thesis large-scale structure project and jumping on this my PhD project, which is more galaxy merger, black hole merger related, I really thought that I was kind of leaving one thing and going to a different thing. But I didn't see all of the through lines that really do exist. And there's even more of them than I realized, but there are a lot of connections between my current projects and my old one. And that was kind of exciting for me to know that I'm not in a completely new realm. Like nothing is truly disjointed, it feels, in astronomy.
You know, this is actually really important that I think it's something that most people who go into graduate school don't expect. But I think as they, you know, work to get their PhDs and become bona fide, full-fledged, like, scientists on their own, that they discover that, hey, you know, all of these things that I'm learning along the way, not just things I'm learning from my classes, but things I'm learning from my research and things I'm learning from reading these papers and things I'm learning in these related and adjacent subfields of what I'm studying, they don't just paint a coherent picture where some of these parts in this one field rely on some parts from this other field, but that you yourself, it's like as you learn about these different topics and as you learn about these different aspects of whatever you're involved with, it's like you're gaining tools in your toolkit, problem-solving tools in your toolkit. And so if you put effort into learning about stars, or you put effort into learning about dark matter and structure formation, or you put effort into learning about feedback between star formation and the distribution of gas and dust, or you put effort into learning about the dynamical heating of dark matter due to the motions of baryons, all of these things are going to go together, and you will discover that when you approach this problem, you have a different set of tools at your disposal than most of the other researchers at it who maybe studied a different set of aspects or focused on things like dust and extinction, or who focused on the observational aspects of it, or who focused on the instrumentation aspects of the observatories that are viewing these objects, that you bring your own unique toolkit to the table, and that gives you a fresh and unique perspective that can be incredibly valuable, not only in terms of making original contributions to the field, but in terms of being a part of a collaboration that other people can depend on and rely on for a perspective that they wouldn't necessarily get without you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't anticipate being able to employ either the science skills or even like the sort of statistics skills that I had garnered from my dark matter project to this merger project. But I absolutely can. And I'm learning new, as I get deeper into it, I'm learning new links. Like it feels like every day, and it's very fun. It's very exciting.
So let me set up sort of this problem for our for our listeners out there that, okay, we've got two galaxies and maybe one's larger than the other, or maybe they're comparable sizes to one another. But in general, these galaxies that form, they're going to have a mix of gas and dust and stars within them. And they're going to have supermassive black holes in or near the galactic center. But now these galaxies are in the vicinity of one another. Maybe they're in the same galactic group or cluster, or maybe one is a satellite of the other. But over time, these galaxies are going to gravitationally interact, and there's a good chance that eventually they will merge together. They will interact so significantly that they'll start merging to form one future, you know, larger galaxy that is the sum of both progenitors. But it's rare to find a galaxy that has multiple supermassive black holes within it. In fact, almost all of the ones we find that have multiple supermassive black holes within them show evidence for a very recent, in cosmic time, a very recent merger between galaxies. So something must be happening to either eject one of these black holes or bring these black holes together so that they merge. And that seems to be a complicated problem that's attracted a lot of research interest in, I'll say, the past two decades. Is this the specific problem that you're looking at? And if so, can you tell us about what not only normal matter is doing, but what dark matter is doing to perhaps help us understand how this issue is going to resolve itself?
So I would say what I'm now working on, what I've transitioned to working on for the rest of my PhD, is kind of a little narrow subset of this very wide problem that you beautifully introduced. So maybe the best way to get at what I'm kind of working on is to talk a little bit about what my advisor does. So my main advisor, Professor Kelly Holly Bachelman here at Vanderbilt, she's pretty firmly a black hole gravitational wave person. She's super duper involved with LISA, laser interferometer space antenna. Essentially, it's think LIGO, so the gravitational wave observatory that's here on Earth, but think of it like in space. Essentially, she's super involved with that, so she's very, very interested in the kinds of massive black hole mergers that are going to generate gravitational waves that we could hopefully observe with LISA and these other instruments. And so, what Kelly cares about a lot, or one of the things she cares about a lot, is the time scale for these mergers. So how long will they take? And then inherently, what are all of the different factors that go into estimating or predicting that time scale? And it turns out there are a ton of factors that go into trying to figure out how long a black hole merger will actually take. Everything from the orbital dynamics of the host galaxy as it's falling in, which is kind of where my work comes in, but we'll get into that, to like the orbital dynamics, to gas, the gas disk that surrounds the primary black hole, to, as I was saying earlier, the dark matter that's in the host galaxy. Like, all of these things can impact the time scale that it takes for the merger to go on. And so where my work lies is in trying to unpack the relationship between the orbital dynamics of the merging galaxies and the subsequent timescale of the black hole merger. So this is looking at stuff like the eccentricity of the infalling galaxy, so how circular or parabolic the orbit is. This is looking at the orbital direction with relation to all of the stellar material. So once you get to the kind of core, the sort of central bit of the merged galaxy, and you've got all these stars and things like that, is the secondary black hole orbiting with or against the current, so to speak, of all the stellar material? All of these orbital dynamics actually impact how long it takes for the merger to happen. So I'm now thinking a lot more about the, I guess, the baryons in the situation than I used to when I was thinking more about large scale structure and dark matter. But as I said, the dark matter is still definitely implicated because it is one of the many factors that could interact with the gravitationally, at least, like with the black hole in question. And you're always looking for, with these mergers, what you're always looking for is what is the mechanism by which energy or angular momentum is being extracted from the orbit in order to shrink the orbit. Because if you want a merger, you want these two black holes to get close. That's what you need. And so you're always looking for what is the mechanism by which the orbit is shrinking. It could be interactions with stars, bouncing off of them, exchanging energy with them. That's called stellar scattering. It could be interaction with circumbinary gas, so the gas disk that surrounds the black hole binary. It could be dynamical friction. So in the early stages of the merger, as the black hole is falling in, it's kind of a little fish in a big pond, so to speak, because there's an entire galaxy that it's moving through. And that wake, that gravitational wake, necessarily impacts the orbit. So all of these mechanisms are mechanisms by which the orbit shrinks, and they all impact the timescale of the merger. So that is the realm that I now work in, but you can already see there's links between this work and the work that I used to do, because to even get to this phase, the first thing that you need is a galaxy merger. And so you are necessarily thinking about all of these questions that I used to think about, where I'm thinking of how close the galaxies are and which galaxies are in the same group and things like that. So there is a very clear through line between what I used to work on and what I now work on.
No, and that's huge. And that means that's one reason why you're an excellent person to work on this problem, is because you already have this experience working on such a closely related problem. And this is a big problem of physical scales, right? When we talk about galaxies merging together, galaxies can be big things. They can be thousands or even hundreds of thousands of light years in size. And so when you have two of them merged together, in general, the supermassive black holes within them aren't going to start off very close to one another. They're going to be separated by a large distance, maybe even by thousands of light years, like we see in many cases. But somehow, over time, interactions of these black holes with the other matter in the galaxies, not just with each other, but with the stars and the gas and the dust and the plasma and the dark matter, it's going to cause these black holes to mutually sink towards the same central point within the galaxy. We have a terrible name for this process that I wish we had a better name for, that we call mass segregation. But what it tells us is that, oh, we have high mass things when they're in an environment with a bunch of lower mass things. The high mass things preferentially get drawn into the center, while the lower mass things sort of get scattered around and knocked up to higher, more energetic orbits. So there is this angular momentum and momentum exchange that happens, where light things get thrown out or scattered into the outskirts and heavy things sink towards the middle. But how does this happen? Is this driven by the large mass things like stars? Is this driven by the smaller mass things like gas and dust? Or is it driven by, like, I sometimes picture what happens when you drive a semi-truck through a cloud of mosquitoes, and none of the mosquitoes smash into your windshield, but the mosquitoes, they get diverted around the truck by the wind, and they swirl around behind the truck in the turbulent airflows generated by the truck. And that's kind of how I look at what we call this dynamical friction of dark matter acting on black holes, is that, yeah, there'll be a tiny amount of dark matter that the black hole plows into, and, you know, you get this inelastic collision where it adds to the mass of the black hole. But most of this dark dark matter is just going to be gravitationally scattered, but it's going to have this effect that we call dynamical friction, where it's actually going to work to very, very, by a very minuscule amount, slow down the motion of the black hole through the galaxy and cause its orbit to decay a little bit. And the reason we care about all of this is we know in the very end stages of this, when you get not 1,000 light years or 100 light years or even 1 light year away, but when they get very close to each other, like solar system scale close to each other, finally, these black holes are going to emit gravitational waves and in spiral, just like the ones that LIGO has already seen for these low-mass black holes, but they're going to be doing it with black holes that are millions or even billions of times the mass of our sun, rather than a few or a few tens or maybe 100 times the mass of our sun.
Yes. Yes. Kelly's definitely interested in these... The big ones, the supermassive ones, for sure, which that was also something that I had to, in terms of things that my former project did not necessarily prepare me for, I had to get really comfy with the different mass scales of the black holes and which observatories would be able to observe which ones. And so when we're talking about the space antenna, yes, we're definitely talking about these supermassive ones, and these are the ones that in my new project that I'm focusing on in the simulation that I'm using is I'm looking at the big ones.
So can I ask you now that we're thinking about this problem, and how do we get these black holes to shed momentum and angular momentum so that they'll eventually wind up coalescing and merging? When we think about this problem, what are the effects that normal matter is going to have, and where is that going to be important, versus what are the effects that dark matter has, and where is dark matter going to be important?
Mm-hmm. So I think we should start at maybe the kind of beginning stages of the merger when the two black holes are still far from each other. So In this picture, we've got a galaxy merger that has happened, is happening, and both galaxies house a supermassive black hole. And so now as the galaxies are in this process of merging, the secondary black hole, so the black hole that's housed by the infalling galaxy, is going to make its long, long, long journey to this center point to merge with the primary. So in the early stages here, we are our most efficient mechanism for this orbital decay that we're talking about is, again, this dynamical friction. So last time I said that with this dynamical friction case, our secondary black hole is kind of like a little fish in a big pond. And when I say little fish, I don't mean mass wise. I mean, like, spatially, it's got a long journey ahead of it. It's got a long way to go. And so it's your cloud of mosquitoes example was so beautiful because it's so much like that. You have all of this at these far reaches. You have all this dark matter, right? That has got mass, and so we have gravity to worry about. And so it is going to institute this sort of gravitational wake that, as the black hole is plunging through, behind it, dark matter will sort of coalesce in response to its gravity and work to slow it down and extract energy from the orbit. And so this is where dark matter is going to matter a lot, because at these far reaches, we don't have the density of stellar material that we're going to see when we get to a further along point of the merger. So dark matter is really going to matter here in this dynamical friction phase. And here, we're, you know, many parsecs away from the merger actually occurring. Once we start making our way to the core, I'm talking about, like, the black holes now are like 10 parsec away from each other. So we're getting a lot closer. Now we have to worry more about stellar material, because we've got a density of stars here where stars really start to matter, and dynamical friction is actually no longer going to be the most efficient way to extract energy from this orbit. What's going to be the most efficient way is this stellar scattering, where now every star that comes by is going to have this scattering interaction with our secondary black hole, where some energy is exchanged, some angular momentum is exchanged, and the shrinking of the orbit that happens during this phase, we call that stellar hardening. So it's basically just a fancy way of saying that these little energy exchanges are going to sap energy away from the orbit, give it to the stars, which effectively, as you were saying, kicks them out. And this is sort of a scouring out of this core region. So our stars are getting kicked out of this central zone, and that's shrinking the orbit further. So something interesting that happens here is now we go from talking about a primary black hole and a secondary black hole, which are on their way to each other, to now talking about this black hole binary. So the two of them at this separation have sort of gravitationally latched onto each other. They're kind of locked in. And now we're talking about them as this binary object that is hopefully on its way to a merger. Okay, so here we are. We're 10 parsec out. We're kicking stars out. We're using that energy exchange to shrink our orbit, and we've got this bound black hole merger system. So here is where things get very interesting for me as someone who cares about orbital dynamics. You have to, it turns out, be thinking about whether your infalling black hole is going against or with the current of the stellar material, because earlier I said that the two things that are being exchanged here are energy and angular momentum, and that is true. A loss of energy on the part of the black hole binary shrinks the orbit and brings them closer. But what about angular momentum? What does it really mean to lose or to gain angular momentum? So when we think about like planet orbits in the solar system, for example, we know that they're like very, very nearly circular. And so if we go all the way back to kind of like physics, like one, and we think about angular momentum from a purely sort of formulaic standpoint, it is, you know, the cross product of a linear momentum and then some radial distance. And so angular momentum is going to be maximized when the radial distance and the linear momentum are perpendicular, and that happens for perfectly circular orbits. So the highest angular momentum you're going to have is for a perfectly circular orbit. So to lose angular momentum is to say my orbit's becoming more eccentric. Why does that matter here? Again, eccentricity, if you kind of go back to the physics one way of thinking of it, is a relationship between the distance of closest approach and the distance of furthest approach in an orbit, the epicenter and the pericenter. And so as the relationship or the ratio between the closest and furthest approach gets more and more disparate, you have a more eccentric orbit, because a circular orbit is really defined by the closest and furthest approach being the same. The distance between the two objects is always the same. That's what a circle is. As those distances get more disparate, you get a more eccentric orbit. So now let's relate this back to our black holes. As they plunge closer to each other and they get more eccentric, meaning their distance of closest approach is getting closer, what are we really working towards here? We're looking to get them close enough for gravitational wave emission to dominate. So as they plunge closer to each other, gravitational wave emission corresponds to orbital frequency. And so the closer they get, the stronger the gravitational waves out. That saps even more energy from the orbit and it speeds up the merger. So the takeaway from all of that is that higher eccentricity is going to accelerate the merger. And so how do we get a higher eccentricity? That's where the orbital dynamics come in. It turns out that if the secondary black hole is orbiting with the currents or going with the grain of the stellar material, it's going to have a lower eccentricity, more circular orbit. But if it is going against the grain, it's going to receive more kicks to its eccentricity. It's going to lose more angular momentum to the stars around it. So going against the current, going against the grain, increases eccentricity and actually speeds up the merger. So that is the relationship between orbital dynamics, this baryonic matter, and then the time scale of this merger. And it's there where I am working now.
You know, Keyshawn, that's really interesting. And for some reason, it makes me think of some things that I learned in my childhood that I thought would be more relevant to my adult life. One of those things was quicksand, and another one of those things was whirlpools in water. I had thought I was going to encounter these much more often as an adult than I actually have. But I know that if you are in like a whirlpool system in the water, if you want to try and escape from that whirlpool or keep yourself from getting funneled into the middle as long as possible, your best bet is to swim with the current. That whatever direction that current is dragging you around in, you want to try and swim in that direction, and that will keep you away from the center for as long as possible. But if you happen to find yourself swimming against the current in the opposite direction to the way the whirlpool is flowing, it's going to draw you into the center even more quickly. And I kind of feel like at long last, that's actually relevant for what you're talking about here in our adult lives is, if you are swimming with the current, if your black hole is moving around one another, if your black holes are moving around one another in the same direction that the stellar matter is all swirling around, that's going to circularize you and make it more difficult to sort of get drawn into the middle. But if the black holes happen to be going in the opposite direction of that, it's going to be much easier to sort of draw them into the center, at least during periapsis rather than apoapsis, right? When they're at closest approach rather than at farthest approach. Is that kind of what's going on here, that you're saying, look, we have all this other matter that is not only existing throughout the galaxy, but also exists in and gets funneled into the galactic center? And so if your black holes are co-orbiting with all of that matter, they're going to stay circular for quite a long time, most likely. But if the black holes are orbiting counter to that motion, if they're orbiting in the opposite orientation, then that's going to sort of collapse this orbit, make it more elliptical, and give you a better chance of having a really close approach between these two black holes that is going to start emitting significant amounts of gravitational waves.
That's absolutely perfect. I might have to use that sometimes when I talk about this stuff. The whirlpool example is incredible. That's exactly what's going on. And something that you said that I'm glad you said is that, so when I mentioned that eccentricity is this sort of ratio between this, you know, periapsis and apoapsis, the closest approach and furthest approach. So as I said, it is true that as eccentricity is increasing, the distance of closest approach is getting closer. It is also true the distance of furthest approach is getting farther because that ratio is getting more disparate. But it is at the periapsis, it is at that closest distance that this process, the sort of magic is going on with where the orbital dynamics are really coming into play. And one really interesting thing that I learned when I was doing, I did my qualifying exam last May, and that's where I learned the vast majority of what I know about the context for this project. I learned during studying for this qual. And as I was doing my literature review, one absolutely fascinating thing that I learned was that during this stellar hardening phase, where stars are kind of responsible for the bulk of the energy and angular momentum transfer that's going on. So as I was saying, there's two ways to really be hardening your orbit right now. There is the energy loss, so shrinking the orbit through losing energy to these surrounding stars. And then there's the angular momentum loss, which results in this eccentricity kick, which results in this deeper plunge toward the center and more gravitational waves out. It turns out that if you're just looking at pure energy loss, if you're just defining your hardening as just like a rate of change in like the orbital energy, it's actually swimming with the current of the stars that results in faster shrinking. If you're only looking at energy, the stellar exchanges, every interaction with a star results in greater loss of energy in this swimming with the current case than against. But once you open it up to looking at angular momentum, overall, the mergers go faster if you're swimming against the current, because the eccentricity effect is apparently so important here that makes the overall merger speed up relative to the swimming with the current case. And then the other interesting thing here to think about is linking the prior phase, the dynamical friction phase, to this phase. You also have to think about what eccentricity did the black hole have when it came in to begin with, right? Because it's been going through this dynamical friction, it's been evolving, its orbit has been changing. But you have to think about what was the eccentricity when it first fell in. And to get there, you're back to thinking about galaxy mergers, because the black hole at first was being carried by a host galaxy. So you have to think about the orbital dynamics of the galaxy at infall. And so you're back to thinking about groups, you're back to thinking about things like that. And so the answer to that question is that for a black hole that comes in at a lower eccentricity, a more circular orbit, it is harder for it to increase its eccentricity. If it comes in very circular, it tends to stay very circular even through this stellar scattering phase. If it comes in very eccentric, it tends to become much more eccentric, much faster. So if it comes in already with a somewhat high eccentricity, then that merger is going to be even more accelerated as it experiences greater kicks to its eccentricity. So there are just so many layers here, and thinking about where dynamics can impact the time scale of a merger.
You know, I'm sure this next question is going to be me getting way ahead of myself, because as you know, and as all of our listeners should know, we've never seen a merger of two black holes more than about 100 solar masses each, right? We've never seen what happens with these supermassive black holes merging together. The closest we've ever found is with systems like we have in the quasar OJ287, where you have like, okay, we've identified that we have two supermassive black holes. I think in that case, one is somewhere around 10 or 20 billion solar masses, and the other is somewhere around 150 million solar masses, and they orbit each other on a rather eccentric around 11-year orbit. But I'm a little curious, when we now think about these galaxies that are going to be merging, or that have already merged, and they have black holes within them that are already merging, or that are in the process of, hey, we're going to merge really soon. Do we have any expectation for what circumstances and how often we should see black holes on roughly circular orbits versus when we see black holes on extremely eccentric orbits? Can we use our simulations at this point in time to help us sort of predict what sorts of populations are going to be out there and how abundant are they going to be relative to each other? Or is this the sort of thing where, you know, you can maybe say something you expect, but really we need the data before we're going to know anything about this for certain?
That's actually a beautiful question. And so I don't think that we have something like this right now, because I think this is just like an extremely active area. So I can say more about kind of what some of my plans are research-wise, because it's relevant to this. So one thing that I am looking to do is in the simulations that we're using, kind of exactly what you just described, I am looking to characterize sort of frequencies or like statistical distributions of how these, how these galaxies are falling in when they infall for a merger. What kind of orbital eccentricity do they have? That's number one. And then two, this essentially get like a co-encounter rotating fraction for the sim that I'm using. Like, how many of these black holes secondaries are co or counter rotating with respect to the merged galaxies that they're falling into. So I am looking to characterize this, get a sense of this statistical distribution. Now, with the caveat being him just using one, like I will just be using one like relatively small like simulation, you know, box. Like it's not going to be the definitive answer for like all of the universe, but in the box that I'm using, yes, I am looking to characterize the fraction of these black holes that are co-rotating with their environments versus counter-rotating, just because I that is something that I don't really think has necessarily been done before. I don't think people usually do that in their sims. I don't think they necessarily look at distributions of eccentricities or fractions of co or counter rotating entities. I don't think that kind of quantitative approach is something that people do. And so that is something that I am hoping to do in my own work. So yeah, I mean, the question you asked is great because it kind of gets at one of the hearts of what my project is going to be. And I guess I'll say that also is a place where I saw a through line between my current work and my old work, because in the past project, which I'm, you know, wrapping up papers and prep now, it was a group finding algorithm to determine which galaxies live together in the same dark matter halo. And for that, I used basically statistics that I ran on a particular simulation box to figure out. I used velocities to relate satellite fractions. So what percentage of satellite candidates of a particular central dark matter halo turned out to actually be satellites as per the sim that I was using. And I used that to make predictions given, if you give me a galaxy catalog, I'd be able to make predictions based on what I ascertained from my sim. And that's kind of exactly what I'm planning to do again. But this time, instead of looking at velocities of halos, dark matter halos, I'm looking at orbital dynamics. I'm looking at eccentricities of infalling galaxies, and I'm looking at co and counter rotating fractions. So it's kind of like same, but different. And I wasn't expecting it to be that way, but it looks like it will be that way.
I mean, that's a fascinating lesson to learn. I think it's also remarkable to realize that, you know, I can imagine that many different astrophysicists who are thinking about this problem are focused on many different aspects of what can affect these mergers, you know, from the beginning until the very end. And that maybe you have groups of people out there who are focused on, okay, what's the difference if the biggest galaxy in this merger is a spiral galaxy versus a barred spiral galaxy versus a galaxy with a large central bulge versus an elliptical galaxy, because that's going to affect the motion of the stars and gas and dust within it, or whether there's even dust within it at all. And that's going to impact how these black holes wind up. I can imagine that for someone like you, you say, well, I want to look at the dark matter and the dark matter halo relative to the galaxy. And how are things going to change when the black hole moves through the dark matter halo? Will it matter whether the halo is fixed and stationary or whether the halo is tumbling relative to the baryonic matter in the galaxy? Will it matter, you know, if I'm co or counter rotating or rotating at some, you know, perpendicular angle to the plane of angular momentum of the dark matter in the galaxy? I would imagine that there are a lot of possible things that you can choose to include, and that what you'll want to do is make a simple model that's simple enough that you can simulate it with the tools and the resources you have at your disposal, but that's complex enough that will allow you to quantify the effects that you're looking for between the dark matter and black hole interactions, so you can compare it to some of those other effects at various scales. And so you know when you do go to simulate this end to end, what effects become important at what times? Because one of the things you want to maximize is your simulation accuracy, and one of the things you want to minimize is the computational intensiveness of the simulations that you need. You don't want to be wasting your resources on computing extraneous things that aren't going to be relevant, but you also don't want to miss out on that key behavior that you're seeking to identify. Is there any way that you can work to thread that needle?
Yeah, so I think you're really spot on in saying that the thing that we would all like, the thing that we would all love at the end of the day, and that my advisor is her kind of her real like white whale in all of this, it would be that equation that incorporates all the different parameters and says, based on all of these circumstances specific to this binary, here is the time scale that you could expect for this merger to take place. That would be the thing that we all dream of having. Getting there, though, is going to take a lot of work on a lot of different scales, on a lot of different parameters. So it's more like the prong of it that I am going to be working on, my PhD that I am working on, is this orbital dynamics angle. But just as you said, there's a dark matter angle to it. There's a circumbinary gas angle to it. There are so many different considerations that people will need to make in order to make this kind of like big like equation with great predictive power. And so I'm coming at this from this one tiny place within a big wide world of parameters that will need to be worked on. And at the end of the day, like, yes, I think the thing that we could do would, like you're saying, be to use this big, powerful predictive equation that doesn't exist yet to model mergers in a way that's an improvement upon what a lot of sims do now, because it's an issue of like spatial sort of resolution. They can only resolve so much. When you get black holes to within a particular distance, a lot of the time sims will just say, okay, they are merged. They are now one, which is that is a way to handle it, definitely. But if we could improve upon that, that would be great. So if we could say more about the time scale at which we actually expect that to happen, instead of just saying, okay, they're close, now they're merged. But if we could actually predict the time scale, so we could, you know, we could employ a when that happens, when they are merged, if we could actually say more about even a likelihood that they reach merger based on maybe the eccentricity of the infalling black hole, based on the co or counter rotating status of that black hole. If we could say more about whether it's even likely to reach merger and then how long that takes, any of those things are improvements upon just saying they're close. Okay, now they're merged. So yes, I think to improve our simulations without making them much more computationally expensive is the goal, but getting there is going to require people doing like kind of like what I'm doing, but for a bunch of different parameters. And then like, I guess we would combine them at the end of the day, we would combine them to come up with this big, the one equation to rule them all, I suppose.
No, that's great, because I think there's a big science goal at stake here, right? We know that just looking at galaxies in the universe at different cosmic times, that in the early universe, when we look at really, really great distances, which corresponds to only a short amount of time after the Big Bang, galaxies are more numerous, lower in mass, but still have often very massive black holes at their centers. Then, as you come to later times, you find that high mass galaxies that have clearly grown both via mergers and by accretion of surrounding matter, they're much more common than they were early on, and they still have really big black holes. But every once in a while, you'll find a galaxy that doesn't really obey the same stellar mass to black hole mass relation that most galaxies do, right? Today, if we look at most of the big massive galaxies out there that we can identify, they have black holes in them, you roughly say, well, if I look at the stars and I add up the mass of all of the stars in this galaxy, I'm going to get a number. And then if I say, and what is the mass of the supermassive black hole at the center, you get another number. And normally that ratio of the mass in stars to the mass of the black hole, it's pretty consistently about, that ratio is about 1,000 to 1. There's about 1,000 times as much mass in stars as there is mass in the central supermassive black hole. And that's true for a wide variety of large, massive modern-day galaxies. But there are a few exceptions. We see a few galaxies that we can't find a supermassive black hole in them at all. We find galaxies, and our Milky Way is one of them, that has a severely undermassive black hole within it, where that ratio is maybe 100,000 or 1,000,000 to 1 instead of that more typical 1,000 to 1. And there are even a few instances, although these are rare, they do exist, where we see galaxies that appear to be in the process of ejecting their central supermassive black hole. And I'm really curious if you think this line of research that not just you are working on, but that your whole community is working on, is going to be able to identify under what circumstances are we likely to get a black hole ejection from this merger process? And will we someday be able to use this information to learn if the Milky Way had at some point in its past actually lost its original supermassive black hole, and the little rinky-dink 4 million solar mass thing we have now, is that just our best attempt to regrow one after losing our original one? What I'm curious what you think about any of that.
That is such an interesting question. I've never thought about this question before. If I had to give my best guess as to what our world of research would have to say about this. So there is one of my friends and colleagues, Crystal, works on recoil, like kicks from this exact kind of thing where a merger will happen. And so gravitational wave recoil is when a merger happens, gravitational waves are emitted, and there's this sort of very violent recoil that the now merged black hole will experience. So one of my friends and colleagues in my research group, Crystal, works on gravitational wave recoil. So essentially, the merger happens, two black holes become one, gravitational waves are released, and there is this sort of this kick, this sort of violent recoil process where the black hole responds to the release of that gravitational wave radiation by having its velocity, it experiences a literal like shift, like it moves. And there are times when, you know, this recoil can be so violent that the black hole is actually ejected from the system. And then there's other times where it's a three body interaction. So you've got you got essentially a merged black hole where two black holes became one, and then a third player sort of joins the game. And now the question is, okay, what happens now? Does one of the black holes get ejected? Does the new one merge with the now merged one, and they get like a super merged black hole? What actually happens there? And so with regard to what our realm of work would have to say about that, I think the important thing might be timescales. I think maybe if you can get a better sense of how long a merger is supposed to take, then you could get a better sense of how likely it is that the galaxy would find itself in that scenario where it has more than one massive black hole in it at the same time for these kinds of these complicated like multi-body interactions to be taking place, because there's many models out there that detail how exactly these kicks and ejections happen and how often that they happen for a given model or a given sim or something like that. But I think if we could use the methods that I'm talking about to maybe get a better picture of time scale, more accurate picture of time scale, you'd have a better sense of how likely it is that a galaxy would actually find itself even in this scenario to experience these kinds of complicated interactions. So maybe in the future, when we have a better picture of time scale, you could ask yourself, is the reason that the Milky Way's Sagittarius star, the Milky Way's central black hole, is the reason why the mass is kind of underperforming relative to what we expect, is it because at X time, you know, X number of years ago, there was a merger, and then at Y time, Y number of years ago, there was this other black hole that entered the equation, and then there must have been, because of the way the time scale shakes out, there must have been this ejection, right? You could maybe play this game with time scales. So I think that's what I would say as far as the relation between my work and this question is I think time scale would be the key to making those kinds of predictions.
No, I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle. You know, some of the things that we know about our own galaxy's history come from evidence you might not expect. For example, we know when I think five different large progenitor galaxies merged with the Milky Way in the past, you know, I'll say from 5 to 11 billion years ago, based on the populations of globular clusters that we now have in the Milky Way, that if you look at certain sets of globular clusters, you can identify like, oh, this group must have all come into the Milky Way together at about the same time based on stellar ages in there and metallicities in there. And you can see that they're related. And I think they've been able to identify multiple different mergers. It would be really curious if your timescale research was able to dovetail with the globular cluster infall merger past research, and you can maybe someday identify, hey, here's where we think the merger happened that kicked a possibly original black hole out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've literally never thought about that, but now that you say it, it's like, why not? Like, once we know more about predicting these merger timescales, it feels like there's so many things. It would open the door to so many new kinds of inquiry about even our own galaxy. And I guess this is also even cooler because the sort of through line in all of the work that I've done in astronomy since I was an undergrad, I think, has been galaxies, because I've kind of always done different things. I did a project that was more, my first project ever was a research experience for undergrads that was observation. Like, we were looking at gas velocities and gas maps, and it was like purely observation, but it was using Sloan manga, so it was nearby galaxies. And then my next thing was more galactic archaeology, so looking at actual, like, our own Milky Way, and that was more statistical. I was working on the pipeline that would be used to look at stars in the Milky Way's stellar halo. So that was more of a statsy thing, but it still had that galaxy relation because we were talking about the Milky Way. Then my next project was the Dark Matter Halo project, which we talked about today, which galaxies are there too, because I'm talking about assemblages of galaxies. And then finally, my most recent evolution is this project where I'm really still talking about galaxies. So kind of, it seems like as an astronomer, maybe I'm a galaxy guy is what I'm concluding about myself, but that's taken a few different manifestations.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Can I ask you, Keyshawn, if you could fast forward like 30 years ahead in your own life and imagine what you might ask that person who's yourself, but a senior astronomer who's been doing this for a long time, are there questions that you have for that future version of yourself, either about astronomy or galaxies or anything, that you would say, hey, I don't know the answer to this now, but future Keyshawn, Do you think you could tell me the answer to this question? Like, do you have a burning question or set of questions that you would really hope that future version of yourself would be able to answer?
So this is an interesting one, because I think the first question that I would have to ask 30 years in the future me is, I'd have to ask him, like, what is his job? What is he doing for a living? Because I know what I want to be doing for a living. So when I'm done with my PhD here at Vandy, I really, really, really enjoy science education, science communication. I've been working a lot with the planetarium here in Nashville. I've been doing this scientist in the classroom teaching fellowship at a middle school near me. And I really want to kind of pivot hard into planetariums, like directing a planetarium. But I obviously, I'm getting a PhD, so I do still want to stay plugged into what's happening in the astro community. I'm getting this degree, so I know enough about how astronomy professionally is conducted. I know enough about the field that I could be trusted to be the liaison between the general public and the world of professional astronomers. And so for future me, I would ask, are you doing that? Are you doing the thing that you said you wanted to do? And then if the answer is yes, then I would say, okay, you're a doctor. You're still plugged into the astro community. You're still reading papers. What has become of any of the work that you did when you were a grad student? Because I'm curious what people are going to do with my group finder, my group finding algorithm, the paper that's in prep right now, when it comes out later this year. Are people going to use it to find groups? Are people going to improve upon it and build upon it and do other things with it? I'm curious about that. And I'm curious about whether people are going to take the work that I do on merger timescales and build upon that. And like maybe incorporate other types of parameters, maybe think about orbital dynamics that I wasn't even thinking about, maybe look at different configurations, maybe do some of this work that we just talked about on galactic archaeology related back to the Milky Way. Like, I'm just curious what my citations look like. What do the papers that cite me, what do they say? So I would ask my future self that.
You know, it's so curious to wonder about, like, what our research, what's going to become of it? Will it fade into obscurity? Will someone else's research get the fame and glory of, you know, of being the prominent thing that people refer to in the field? Or will what we did wind up having a lasting impact that actually, you know, helps future astronomers make the discoveries that we were hoping they'd be able to make? It's a really fascinating question, and I can't wait to see what happens to you and your career, and in some ways your research legacy, Keyshawn. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm curious, before we let you go, if you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners out there.
I definitely do. So being an astronomer, occasionally you'll get a question about the utility of what we do, of what we study, of the kind of science that we work on. Why should it be funded? Why should we pay for it? All these kinds of things. And I do think a lot about those questions, because I don't think it's fair to just brush them off and say, well, you know, you have the wrong attitude, you have the wrong approach, and then not consider it. No, I do think, as a person who does this work, it is important to actually consider why it is work that should be funded. You know, people who pay taxes have a right to know, like, why some small percentage of their tax money is going to what we do. And in thinking about this, I have determined that I have a really fundamental belief that everybody should be able to pursue the work that makes them feel alive, that makes them feel like life is worth living. And for some subset of the population, that thing is astronomy. And for me, that's reason to fund virtually anyone's passions. However, it happens that we live in a society where people are not necessarily free to pursue what they want to pursue, because we've got all of these systemic, you know, racism and homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia and all these different mechanisms of oppression that keep people from pursuing what what I believe they could excel at if they were free to. And so this has informed my work with an organization called Black and Astro that I'm the events director of. We seek to create space for Black folks in space-related fields to thrive. We create community. And in answering this question of why do this, why fund this, it's because for me, it's the work that I enjoy. I think it does get at fundamental questions about what it means to be human in the universe. But moreover, I think that there's a lot of people in the world who want to be doing this and who are made to feel alive by doing this work. And I wouldn't want to deprive anyone of the joy that I feel when I'm doing this. And so for me, that's the same argument I use for why fund the arts, why fund anything, I think, is because somebody out there needs to feel alive, and this is the thing that makes them feel it. So I guess that's what I would want people to take away.
You know, that's a wonderful sentiment. And I remember someone being asked what they thought was the greatest tragedy of Einstein's life. And their response was that Einstein's life wasn't tragic, but what is a tragedy is that for every Einstein, there are hundreds or thousands or more of people who were probably just as smart, just as talented, with just as much potential, who never had the opportunity to explore and study and even find out what they were really passionate about and what they had an incredible aptitude for. So I'm so pleased to hear that that's something you're passionate about and that you're going to use your life, and you're already using your life, to make a difference in the worlds and lives of others. So thank you, Keyshawn, for being my guest here on the Starts With a Bang podcast. And thanks to all of you out there for tuning in. The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible through the generous donations of our Patreon supporters, and I'd like to thank everyone who donates and supports us at the $5 a month level and up. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chewist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Chikutas, Dominic Turpin, John Mithat, John Van Balaguyan, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, C. Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benishtek LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Giltinen, David Hibbets, David Wallach, George Church, Hirolamo Castaldo, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Ken Lepre, Kilia Opu, Laird Whitehill, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Nick Winland, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Texera, Rafael Wojcik, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanek, Arnulfo Zepeda, Ben Head, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sellards, Carl Iddings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Taschioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Eric Zetterbaum, Flo, Fraser Kane, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Catherine S., Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Lang, Mark Van Coy, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Prochota, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hannes, Neil Flood, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zuzelski, Phil Hallenborg, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Robert Thibodeau, Roger Dennis, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Terry McKeon, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas All, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierkarski, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Van Den Heuvel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.